204 Berry Street. And don't forget to follow Old Farm Fine Foods on Instagram at Old Farm FF to get the scoop on the latest goodies. Old Farm Fine Foods, comfort food you can count on.
What's going on? Just a Tanya Dahaskigo, then on Zewa Dahusa Dadje, Ungahuan, and Hadiwa Nodas, Nene Aboriginal Voices, Oscar Dewa Nyawar Oscar, Ne Jota FM, CFRC.
It is 6 o'clock, and you're tuned to CFRC 101.9 FM. And we broadcast from Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario, Canada. Ani Nichkiwank, Dok Farquhar Dishnikos, Minwa Sean Story. Esna Minwa and Anishinaabe Noewin. And here we go. Aboriginal Voices on this gorgeous Tuesday evening. Sean, it is absolutely gorgeous.
Is it?
Yeah. Are you having fun? Enjoying
this? Well, I've had better days.
The summer weather is making everybody feel good right now.
Is it? Yeah. Well, sometimes it does. Other times it's just incredibly hot. And uncomfortable and not interesting to be around.
Well, that's why we love doing our radio show here at Aboriginal Voices on a Tuesday evening between 6 and 8 p.m. Because the weather's changing.
And air
getting
conditioning.
Cooler. Yeah. and that rain that we're getting is going to be fine.
Yeah, and a week or so ago, we had like a really cool Wednesday, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It was a Wednesday, or maybe it was a Tuesday. Anyways, it was chilly.
Yeah, last Wednesday was about 12 degrees at my place, first thing in the morning.
Uh-huh.
That's, you know, like 7 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, I got a quick idea for you. That I was out on Black Spruce Trail, and it's, you know, yesterday, and it is absolutely a gorgeous trail. Let me describe a little bit to you. First of all, the sky was just that sort of light blue to dark blue as you looked in the distance and then and looked above you. But there were, you know, these puffy little clouds everywhere. There weren't very many of them. And the black spruce on both sides of this open trail. And as we walked, we were walking uphill. So, you know, I wasn't really looking at the distance or anything. But when we came to the crest of this hill that we were on, the tiny black spruce, the closest to us, were probably shoulder height for me. And that would be the same for you.
Oh, yeah? They just planted?
Naturally. Mother Nature put them there. Probably the wind blew some of the seeds out, and these guys germinated and grew there over a couple of years. But the other black spruce, they're all, you know, pretty tall. They're, you know, close to 10 meters, 12 meters high. And I thought, okay, this is good. And as we got, and there's all this sort of wild grasses that are growing. None of them, the seeds look like they're done. I guess they haven't had enough water, or the seeds have gone through their flowering and they're in for next year's wildflowers or wild grasses. So the grasses look fluffy. Okay, they're all bent over, look like they're soft. And the trail itself is sort of flat rocks with a little bit of gravel around them. This is the terrain here. And we're now at the top of this ridge that we were hiking over. And it is sort of a beautiful green-blue colors into the distance. And so, you know, and it's hazy, not smoke hazy. It looks like it's just the moisture from the forest is being picked up into the atmosphere. Anyway, I just wanted to tell you about this because that's been my my experience for the last 3 days doing these hikes, trail hiking.
Hmm.
I thought
of you. Did you get pictures?
I could bring to you later. But I thought of you because I got thinking, you know what? We left a cabin behind to go to another cabin. So these are, you hike 8 to 10 kilometers every so often. You stop at a cabin. Now, if you want to stay there, you can, or you can move on to the next one. And, you know, they're dotted along this trail, Black Spruce Country Trail.
Mm-hmm.
And, so we got thinking, oh, you would love this kind of stuff because, until the rain came, it was perfect. But they have outdoor cooking.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. So, I did one day where, I got the fire going. It was kind of hard keeping it going, but we got the fire going, and I did one of our recipes on a cedar plank, and I had a fish with me. Now, I didn't have salmon, but we brought along a trout, a lake trout, and it was smoky, and the heat all around just got it going. And I questioned, why did I bring this great big heavy-duty cast iron frying pan with me? But I'm glad I did, because all the vegetables went into the frying pan and we cooked them up while the fish was getting its cedary smoke flavor and cooking. And when we finished, everybody ate up all the vegetables and I had a little bit of fish left over.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, so I'm glad I brought that big frying pan.
If I would have went, you'd have had a lot of fish left over.
What? Don't you like fish? Oh. Okay, so next time I'll have to take venison on a trip with him when I take you out.
Yeah, whatever.
Mm-hmm. We'll make a venison stew.
Okay.
Good. So what have you been up to these days?
Busy, busy, busy.
Mm.
Nothing I can tell you about but busy.
No, but are you still taking folks to their medical appointments?
Or? Not as much now.
No, okay.
But still busy.
Yeah.
Actually, I am. Sorry, I got to go and do that.
Ooh.
Today, or yet,
later today.
Yeah.
Okay.
So...
Yeah, I know what you mean. All right. So, any news that you have?
Nothing. Says oh, here that nice. Duty to consult the indigenous leadership crucial for to development, say First Nations.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about this on Aboriginal Voices a while back. Remember when Doug Ford was talking about having the province of Ontario put through Bill 5 and they rushed it through and it took away Bill 5. People didn't know about it. Not very many people I know have talked about it.
But no, it was a quick one.
Yeah, and then the federal government also came up with a Bill C-5, which C stands for Canada. I'm not surprised that First Nations leaders are saying, wait just a minute.
Yeah.
They had a gathering a week ago, I think it was, where the Prime Minister met with... people in Gatineau at the big museum there, Museum of Civilization. Remember that?
Kinda.
Mm. Yeah. That kind of felt strange to me because the Prime Minister had invited 656 chiefs from across Canada to come and meet, but it was only First Nations. So the Métis and the Inuit were not included in this meeting, which is fine. So it's all First Nations. But what I was surprised was I think the leaders, the chiefs, already have their weeks planned out, a couple of weeks in advance. Some were busy with forest fires. Some were busy with you know, getting things set up in their communities for whatever reason related to summertime. And here we are, the government of Canada just says, you've got 5 days, everybody come to Ottawa, and we're going to talk. And well, I don't think the leaders had read Bill C-5 before it was ever passed into law. But I know some lawyers have met and talked about it, but this is just too fast. You know, it's just weird.
Let's see, Doug. Mm-hmm. We have Thunder Bay, the first nations involved in Ring of Fire, in three Ring of Fire road projects, came together this week and reaffirmed their commitment to indigenous-led development. Martin Falls, a Webakwe First Nations, held a ceremony where their respective chiefs, council members, elders, and community members were joined by staff of a mining company, Wei Lu, in the deconstruction of a teepee, said a media release issued by Martin Falls. Deconstruction of a teepee.
I don't know. Well, the term deconstruction is kind of weird. Did they destroy it? Did they burn it? Or did they dismantle it?
I don't know. The First Nations are proponents behind the Martin Falls Community Access Road, the Webakwe Supply Road, and jointly the Northern Road Link that would connect the two roads, which would connect their communities to the provincial highway system, as well as allowing access to the mineral-rich Ring of Fire region.
Mm. There's going to be a lot of discussions around all of this, but you know, my first thought would be the environmental issue when it comes to the animals that travel through that area, you know, caribou and deer and elk and moose, and then all of the birds that travel through. And we don't know anything about bears because I think most of the bear population information has been withheld from the public. So we'll see. It's going to be interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think this whole idea there of pushing this road through fast is has been in the works probably with the Conservative government of Ontario for at least 7 years now. So I know that there was some talk about we're going to race this one through. But at first, when they first got in 7 years ago or 8 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, so... Yeah, here we are. The people in the South don't understand what's really happening, do they?
Probably not.
Yeah.
Good chance they don't.
Yeah, but anyway. So I'm wondering if we should get a protest song to listen to right now.
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay. I'll grab one from the vaults, okay?
Sounds good.
And we'll be back in a bit. There's got to be one from Robbie Robertson's.
Okay. It's a good day to die. That'd be a protest.
Yeah. Okay.
Thirsty. chief's eyes were sad, but showed no sign of fear. It is a good day to die.
It is a good day to die.
Oh, my children, dry your eyes.
It is a good day to die.
And he spoke of the days before the white man came, with his guns and whiskey. He told of a time long ago, what you call history. The general couldn't believe his words, nor the look on his face. And he knew these people would rather die than have to live in this disgrace. What law have I broken? What wrong have I done?
Hey everyone, welcome back for another deep dive. Today we're going to be looking into something that you might not know a lot about, and it's a part of Canadian history that is getting more attention these days, and that's Indian day schools.
Right.
So we're going to be looking at an article that's from Active History, and it's talking about how digital history techniques can help us understand these schools.
Yeah, this is a really interesting area because a lot of people now know about the residential school system, but the day schools were kind of operating in parallel with that.
Right.
They had a similar goal.
Yeah.
Assimilation was the goal.
Right.
But the difference was with the day schools, the students could go home.
Oh, so they were going home at night, but still the aim was to strip them of their culture and their language.
Exactly.
Wow. So it's like, it's almost more insidious.
In a way, yeah. You can think about it. The impact wasn't just on the child.
Yeah.
On the whole family structure, the whole community structure, because you had this tension between what was happening at home and the enforced values of the school.
That's really interesting. And one thing I'm noticing as we're talking about this is that there's not a lot of research on day schools compared to residential schools.
That's right. There is a lack of scholarship.
Why is that? Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's a number of factors.
Yeah.
Partly it's because residential schools were more centralized. It's easier to track and study them.
Right.
But I think there's also this perception that because day school students went home, that their experiences were somehow less significant.
Oh, wow.
Like the trauma was minimized because they weren't completely removed from their families.
That's heartbreaking. So how does this digital history project help to fill in some of those gaps?
Well, this project has actually used digital tools and GIS mapping.
Okay.
You can think of it like Google Maps on a historical level.
Right.
To create a website. And the website is called www.indiandayschools.org.
Okay, so write that down, everybody. www.indiandayschools.org. We'll put that in the show notes, too.
Yeah, and it's really become a resource for survivors and anyone who wants to understand this part of Canadian history.
Now, you mentioned a time-lapse map.
Yes.
Can you sort of paint us a picture of what that is and what it shows?
Sure. So imagine a map of Canada. And as the years go by on this map, little dots start appearing. And each of those dots represents an Indian day school.
Okay.
And what's really striking is that you can see the way that they develop.
Okay.
So pre-World War II, the growth is fairly slow.
Mm-hmm.
But then after the war, there's this huge expansion.
Wow.
Especially in the 1960s and 70s.
And especially in the north.
And particularly in the north.
Okay, so I'm already starting to think about what was happening in Canada in the 60s and 70s. wasn't that a time of like a lot of resource development?
Absolutely.
Particularly in the north.
Yeah.
Like mining and oil exploration and all that kind of stuff.
You're exactly right.
Yes.
So this map is not just showing us schools.
Right.
It's actually reflecting this broader historical context.
Right. So these day schools, which were kind of presented as a, you know, a way to educate Indigenous children, were really part of like a way to control and assimilate.
Yeah. You have to remember the goal of assimilation was to basically strip children of their language and culture.
Right.
And when you do that, you're essentially creating a workforce that's less likely to resist,
right,
you know, these incursions into their traditional territories.
It's a little bit unsettling, isn't it, when you start to see those connections?
It is.
And wouldn't the location of day schools also benefit these resource companies? I mean, like, if you think about, if you need workers,
right,
wouldn't it make sense to have a school right there producing them?
Ah, that's a really interesting point. It adds another layer of complexity to this whole thing.
Yeah.
It suggests that these schools weren't just about cultural erasure, but also about creating this readily available and compliant workforce.
So it's like we're peeling back layers of history here and kind of revealing connections that maybe were obscured on purpose. And this map is like a key to unlock that hidden narrative.
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah. Now, I understand that the researchers found a bit of a gap.
Yes.
In the information available for a certain period of time.
That's right. There's a significant gap in the archival information.
Okay.
For the period between about 1953 and the 1960s.
Oh, wow. So right in the middle of when all this stuff was really taking off.
Exactly. Okay. The peak years of the day school system.
So are the records just gone?
Well, no, it's more complicated than that. It's because of privacy concerns.
Oh, okay.
A lot of the records from that period are still sealed.
Right.
So it makes it really difficult to get a complete picture of what was actually happening in the schools during those years.
So how do we fill in those gaps then?
Well, this is where oral histories become absolutely essential.
So we're relying on people's memories.
Yes.
Mm.
We need those stories and experiences of survivors from that era. They hold the key to understanding what was going on.
So those stories are really valuable, not just for historical accuracy, but also for
much more than that.
Yeah, like a deeper kind of healing and understanding.
Exactly. For a lot of survivors, sharing their experiences is a way of reclaiming their past.
Yeah.
It's a way of validating the pain that's been ignored mm-hmm. or dismissed for so long.
It's like their stories were silenced both by the system itself and then also by this lack of research and recognition.
Exactly. And by bringing those voices to the forefront,
yeah.
we're not just learning about history.
Right.
We're actually participating in this process of truth and reconciliation.
Speaking of connecting the dots, you mentioned earlier this lawsuit, National Class Action Lawsuit for Indian Day School Survivors.
Right.
It kind of fits into all of this, doesn't it? Like seeking justice and recognition for those harms.
It certainly does. Yeah. It was a long and complex process, but it ultimately brought a degree of recognition and a measure of justice.
And that lawsuit actually closed pretty recently, didn't it?
It did. It closed in January of 2023.
So do you see that as kind of a turning point?
I think it's both an ending and a beginning in a way.
Yeah.
The lawsuit itself is over.
Right.
But the work of healing and reconciliation that's ongoing.
Yeah.
And this closure gives us a chance to reflect on what's been accomplished mm-hmm. and to kind of recommit to that process of truth telling.
So it's like a chapter closing, but the story's not over.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's where those oral histories become even more crucial.
Right, because that gap in the information that we talked about,
yes.
the 1950s and 60s when the day school system was at its peak,
right.
those are the years where we need the most voices.
We do.
The most stories.
We need to hear from the people who were there.
Right, because those official records can only tell us so much.
That's right.
It's the personal experiences, mm-hmm. the individual stories that really bring that period to life.
Absolutely. And those stories are still out there waiting yeah. to be heard.
And they need to be heard, not just for the sake of like historical accuracy, but also for the healing of individuals
yes.
and families and whole communities.
Exactly.
This deep dive is really highlighting for me the power of individual stories. Mm-hmm. It's making me think about how history isn't just about, you know, dates and facts.
Right.
It's about lived experiences.
It is. And those experiences, especially when they've been marginalized or silenced, they hold immense power.
Think about what we've uncovered just by looking at this time-lapse map.
Yeah.
It's like this visual representation of a hidden narrative.
And the map is just one piece of the puzzle.
Yeah.
We need those individual stories.
Yeah.
Those oral histories to fill in the gaps.
Right.
To add depth and nuance to our understanding. It's mm-hmm. like we're piecing together this mosaic and each story adds a vital piece.
This reminds me of a story I heard from an elder in my community. She talked about how as a child, she would hide her traditional medicines
oh, wow.
under the floorboards of her room at the day school. It was a way for her to hold on to a part of her culture, even in this environment of forced assimilation.
That's such a powerful image.
Yeah.
It speaks to the resilience and determination
yeah.
of indigenous people to maintain their identities in the face of incredible adversity.
And it really highlights the limitations of those official records. You wouldn't find that story that in a government document.
Right.
But it's so vital for understanding the impact of these schools.
Exactly. Those personal stories, those acts of resistance
yeah.
and resilience, they're what truly illuminate this history.
Yeah.
They remind us that these weren't just systems and policies
yeah.
that were impacting real people.
Real lives.
Real lives.
And those impacts are still felt today. This isn't just about the past.
No.
It's about understanding how that past shapes the present.
Absolutely. The legacy of the Indian day school system,
mm-hmm.
it's complex. It's multifaceted.
Yeah.
It's a legacy of trauma and loss, but it's also a legacy of resilience and survival.
Yeah.
And this ongoing fight for justice and recognition.
You said earlier that the closure of that class action lawsuit
yes.
was both an ending and a beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you see as kind of the next steps in this journey of truth and reconciliation?
I think the closure of the lawsuit allows us to shift our focus away from legal battles and towards deeper forms of engagement.
Okay.
It's about moving beyond just financial compensation
yeah.
and toward meaningful actions that address the root causes of these injustices.
So what would that look like in practice?
Well, it would involve a multifaceted approach.
Mm-hmm.
It means continuing to support the gathering and preservation of these oral histories,
right.
making sure those stories are heard and honored.
And educating ourselves
yes.
about this history and challenging those narratives
Absolutely.
That have minimized or ignored the experiences of day school survivors.
Exactly. It's about fostering a culture of empathy and understanding.
Right.
Recognizing that truth and reconciliation, it's a process that requires the participation of all Canadians.
This deep dive has been incredibly eye-opening for me.
It has for me, too.
And I hope it has been the same for our listeners.
I hope so.
Now, before we wrap up this part of our deep dive, I want to go back to that time-lapse map for a second.
Okay.
I'm struck by how it really connects the expansion of the day school system mm-hmm. with the broader historical context of Canada.
It's a powerful visual tool.
It is. It makes you think about, you know, all the different forces at play, the yeah. connections between these seemingly separate events and how this system was really embedded in this larger story of colonialism.
Exactly.
So if our listener could go back and watch that map unfold again,
mm-hmm.
what would you want them to pay attention to?
I would encourage them to pay attention to the timing
okay.
of when the schools appear and to think about what else was happening in Canada
right.
during those periods.
Yeah.
What were the political and economic trends?
Mm-hmm.
What policies were being enacted? How was the government interacting with Indigenous communities at the time?
So it's about seeing those dots on the map, not just as schools,
right.
but as symbols of this complex and often very troubling history.
Exactly. And by connecting those dots,
yeah.
by understanding that historical context, we can start to really grapple with the legacy of these schools
yeah.
and its ongoing impact on Indigenous peoples and on Canada as a whole.
This has been a really insightful conversation.
It has.
We've explored this chapter of Canadian history that's often overlooked, but incredibly important.
It is.
And we've seen how digital tools like this time-lapse map can help us to understand these yeah. complex historical processes.
And we've also seen how crucial it is to listen to the voices of survivors.
Yes.
To honor their stories yeah. and to recognize that truth and reconciliation is this journey that requires empathy and understanding.
And a commitment to action.
Absolutely.
We'll be back after a short break to wrap up our deep dive into the history of Indian day schools. Wow. Stay with us.
And those stories, they're valuable not just for historical accuracy,
right.
but for something much deeper.
You're talking about like healing and acknowledging what happened?
Exactly.
For many survivors sharing their experiences, it's a way of reclaiming their past.
Yeah.
It's validating that pain that's been ignored or dismissed for so long.
It's like their stories were silenced, both by the sister itself mm-hmm. and by this lack of research and recognition.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And when we bring those voices to the forefront,
yeah.
we're not just learning about history.
Right.
We're participating in a process of truth and reconciliation.
And speaking of connecting the dots, that lawsuit that we talked about earlier.
Yes.
The national class action lawsuit for Indian day school survivors.
Right.
It fits right into this, doesn't it? Seeking justice and recognition for those harms.
It does. Yeah.
yeah.
It was a long and complex process.
Hmm.
But it did bring a degree of recognition and a measure of justice for many survivors.
And it closed just recently in January of 2023.
That's right.
Do you see that as a turning point?
I think it's both an ending and a beginning. The lawsuit itself has concluded.
Right.
But the work of healing and reconciliation that's ongoing and this closure.
Yeah.
I think it gives us a chance to reflect on what's been accomplished
mm-hmm.
and to recommit to that process of truth telling.
It's like a chapter closing.
Yeah.
But the story is far from over.
Exactly. And this is where those oral histories become even more crucial. You remember that gap in the archival information we talked about?
Yeah, the 1950s and 60s.
1950s and 60s, when the day school system was at its peak.
Right.
Those are the years where we need the most voices.
Yeah.
The most stories.
Because official records can only tell us so much.
That's right.
It's the personal experiences, mm-hmm. the individual stories that really bring that period to life.
Absolutely. And those stories are still out there.
Yeah.
They need to be heard.
And they need to be heard not just for historical accuracy,
right.
but for the healing of individuals,
yes.
families, and whole communities.
Exactly.
This deep dive is really highlighting for me the power of individual stories.
Yeah.
It's making me think about how history isn't just about dates and facts. It's about lived experiences.
It is. And those experiences, especially when they've been marginalized or silenced,
yeah.
they hold immense power.
Think about what we've uncovered just by looking at this time-lapse map.
It's true.
It's like this visual representation of a hidden narrative.
And the map is just one piece of the puzzle.
Yeah.
We need those individual stories.
Yeah.
Those oral histories to fill in the gaps, to add depth and nuance to our understanding. It's mm-hmm. like piecing together a mosaic.
Mm.
And each story adds a vital piece to the overall picture.
This reminds me of a story I heard from an elder in my community.
Oh.
She talked about how as a child, she would hide her traditional medicines under the floorboards of her room at the day school.
Wow.
It was a way of holding on to a part of her culture, even in that environment of forced assimilation.
That's such a powerful image.
Yeah.
It speaks to the resilience and determination of indigenous peoples to maintain their identity in the face of incredible adversity.
And it highlights the limitations of official records. You wouldn't find that story in a government document.
No, you wouldn't.
But it's so vital for understanding the impact of these schools.
Exactly. Those personal stories, those acts of resistance and resilience, there would truly illuminate this history.
Yeah.
They remind us that these weren't just systems and policies.
Right.
They were impacting real people, real lives.
And those impacts are still felt today. This isn't just about the past.
It's right.
It's about understanding how that past shapes the present.
Absolutely. The legacy of the Indian day school system is complex and multifaceted.
Yeah.
It's a legacy of trauma and loss, but it's also a legacy of resilience and survival.
Yeah.
And the ongoing fight for justice and recognition.
You mentioned earlier that the closure of the class action lawsuit was both an ending and a beginning.
Yes.
What do you see as the next steps in this journey of truth and reconciliation?
The closure of the lawsuit. I think it provides an opportunity to shift our focus away from those legal battles and towards these deeper forms of engagement.
Okay.
It's about moving beyond financial compensation and towards meaningful actions that address the root causes of these injustices.
So what would that look like in practice?
Well, it involves a multifaceted approach. It means continuing to support the gathering and preservation of oral histories.
Right.
Ensuring that those stories are heard and honored.
And educating ourselves.
Yes.
Learning about this history and challenging those narratives.
Absolutely.
That have minimized or ignored the experiences of day school survivors.
Exactly. It's about fostering a culture of empathy and understanding.
Right.
Recognizing that truth and reconciliation is a process that requires the active participation of all Canadians.
This deep dive has been incredibly eye-opening for me.
It has for me too.
And I hope it's been the same for our listeners.
I hope so.
Now, before we wrap up this part of our deep dive, I want to go back to that time-lapse map for a moment.
Okay.
I'm struck by how it visually connects the expansion of the day school system with the broader historical context of Canada.
It's a powerful visual tool, isn't it?
It is. It makes you think about all the different forces at play.
Right.
The connections between these seemingly separate events and how the system was embedded in this larger story of colonialism.
Exactly.
So if our listener could go back and watch that map unfold again, what would you want them to pay attention to? What questions would you want them to ask themselves?
I would encourage them to pay attention to the timing of the school's appearances.
Okay.
To consider what else was happening in Canada during those periods.
Yeah.
What were the political and economic trends? What policies were being enacted?
Right.
How was the government interacting with Indigenous communities at the time?
It's about seeing those dots on the map, not just as schools,
right,
but as symbols of this complex and often very troubling history.
Exactly. And by connecting those dots, by understanding that historical context, we can begin to grapple with the legacy of these schools and its ongoing impact on Indigenous peoples and on Canada as a whole.
This has been a really insightful conversation.
It has.
We've explored this chapter of Canadian history that's often overlooked, but it's incredibly significant.
It is.
And we've seen how digital tools like this time-lapse map can help us to visualize and understand these complex historical processes.
We've also seen how crucial it is to listen to the voices of survivors.
Yes.
To honor their stories.
Mm-hmm.
And to recognize that truth and reconciliation is a journey that requires empathy, understanding, and a commitment to action.
We'll be back after a short break to wrap up our deep dive into the history of Indian day schools. Stay with us.
We're back and ready to sort of wrap up our deep dive into the history of Indian day schools.
Yeah.
We've covered a lot, haven't we?
We have. We've explored a chapter of Canadian history that often gets overlooked. But it's so important for understanding that relationship between Indigenous peoples and the Canadian government.
Yeah. And one thing that really struck me is how this digital history project with that time-lapse map, it really lets us see the big picture. You know how these schools weren't just isolated places? They were part of this much bigger system of control and assimilation.
Well,
yeah, it's like that map gave us a new lens to view history.
Yeah.
Suddenly the connections between the expansion of day schools and things like resource development and treaty negotiations, they become so much clearer.
Yeah, it's almost like you see this hidden pattern emerge, a pattern that was maybe deliberately obscured for so long. And it makes you wonder what else we might uncover if we use these digital tools on other parts of history.
That's a great question. It speaks to the power of digital history. It lets us revisit the past with fresh eyes.
Right.
Ask new questions.
Yeah.
Challenge existing narratives.
And in this case, it's leading us to a deeper understanding of the Indian day school system and its lasting impact.
Absolutely. But as we've talked about, the map is just one piece of the puzzle. To really get a sense of the human cost of these policies, we need those individual stories, those voices of the people who experience these schools firsthand.
You're talking about the power of oral histories, how those personal accounts fill in the gaps left by the official records and bring this history to life in a way that just statistics never could.
Absolutely. And those stories, they're not just about the past either. They're about the present and the future. They speak to the resilience of indigenous communities, their struggles, and their hopes for healing and reconciliation.
Yeah, this deep dive has really made it clear to me how important it is to listen to those voices, to make space for them to be heard, and to honor the truth of their experiences.
Truth-telling is a crucial step on this road to reconciliation. It's about acknowledging the harms that were done, understanding their lasting impacts, and committing to a different future.
A future where indigenous voices aren't just heard, but they're actually central to shaping the policies and decisions that affect their communities.
Precisely. Reconciliation isn't just about apologies or symbolic gestures. It's about systemic change, about addressing the roots of inequality and injustice. It's about building relationships that are based on respect, understanding, and a shared commitment to a just and equitable society.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, what would you say are the key takeaways you hope our listener walks away with?
Well, first and foremost, I hope they have a deeper understanding of the Indian day school system, its scope, its impact, and its connection to those broader forces in Canadian history.
I would add to that the importance of these digital history tools, like that time-lapse map, you know, for uncovering these hidden narratives, challenging those traditional accounts of the past. And of course, we can't forget the importance of listening to and honoring the voices of survivors.
Beautifully put. Those voices are the heart of the story. They remind us that history isn't just about dates and facts. It's about people's lives and the enduring legacy of the past.
And those stories have the power to inspire us, to challenge us, and to guide us as we move forward on the path towards truth and reconciliation.
So to our listener, I would say this. Take what you've learned from this deep dive and keep exploring. Visit that website we mentioned, www.indiandayschools.org, and dig into the stories and resources there.
Seek out books and documentaries by Indigenous creators. Talk to your friends, family, and community about this history and why it matters today.
And remember that the journey towards truth and reconciliation, it's ongoing. It needs us all to be engaged, informed, and committed to creating a future that's more just and equitable for everyone.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the history of Indian day schools. We hope it's inspired you to keep learning, keep questioning, and keep the conversation going.
The porch light on just in case. Open that door, swings, and I see your face. And I, oh, naive,
and I keep your photograph to this day, wishing and hoping that you're okay. And I, I'm missing you now.
I'm never going to be there on my rave. Kids are going to tell it all our rave. They're not going to have it all on their rave. They're going to
was the same. Love remains. This hurts inside me. Call your name to this day. Wish you were home beside me.
We've left your bedroom in its place. Posters and memories unerased. And I, oh, I even know.
my tears. Seems just like yesterday, although it's been years and I'm missing you now.
I'm never na pitacharon nairale. Kitzachon a tilitao laurale. Zonachon a anitao konerale. Tacharon a.
All the same, love remains. All this hurts inside me. Call your name to this day. Wish you were home beside me. Light on just in case. Open that door, swings, and I see your face. And I
call
your name
to
me. I leave the porch light on just in case. Open that door, swings, and I see your face. And I
Cavalera Loire. All these Dorothy? What's your name?
KPP Concerts has a stacked lineup of all-ages concerts happening at the Broom Factory through the summer into early fall. On June 27th, check out Housewife, followed by Friday's Child at the Broom Factory on July 11th. Then on August 10th, enjoy music from hip-hop artist Matt Mack, followed later by The Dirty Nil on September 19th. Then on September 26th, it's Petite Belle Evo and neo-grunge icons The Bridge City Sinners coming to town on September 27th. And then Yukon Blonde gets us into the fall spirit on September 28th. All shows are all ages at the Broom Factory and co-presented by CFRC 101.9 FM. For a complete list of shows and ticket information, visit kppconcerts.com.
Broadcasting 24/7, 365, you're listening to 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca, Kingston's only campus community radio station. Tune in for the best local programming.